Welcome back. You're still listening to Radio Zomerdam, where today we talk with astroparticle physicist Gianfranco Bertone about our universe. In the song we've just heard, Monty Python quite adequately set the grandeur of our universe, I think, by describing the galaxies, the stars, and how our universe keeps on expanding. And the song seems to capture all of the universe, but the thing is, it couldn't be farther from the truth. Everything that Monty Python describes in the song, the galaxies, the stars, are only one of the building blocks of our universe, and only a fraction. Today we talk about dark matter, which is one of those building blocks. Mr. Bertone, can you explain something about something more about the elements that build our existence?
Absolutely. So, let me first give you the big picture, right? So you said correctly that we believe that there's more in the universe than the matter we have discovered so far. In particular, if you put together all the stars, all the gas, and everything in the universe which is made of atoms, you mentioned earlier, you know, there's gas, there's solid, there's liquid, and, you know, we are familiar with many elements of the periodic table. But if you think about it, everything we see around us, including ourselves, is made of the same basic constituents, the same building blocks, which is atoms. And if you go even, you know, at a smaller scale, they're made of the same particles, which is basically protons and neutrons inside the nuclei. And, you know, fundamentally quarks. They're both made of quarks and electrons surrounding them. So if you take quarks and electrons and, you know, just look at how they combine in the universe, you can get basically, you can basically explain all the physics, the chemistry, and the biology around you, at least in principle.
Everything that we can see.
Everything that we can see, and also, you know, everything we can extrapolate based on what we can see. So, for instance, it's obvious that we cannot see all the stars in the universe. There will be stars which are too faint for us to observe. But based on what we see, we can sort of, you know, do simple extrapolations and figure out what's out there.
And also the energy that surrounds us.
Precisely.
We can extrapolate what it is.
Precisely. Yeah. So, if you just look at what's out there in terms of atoms, we can estimate how much of these atoms is in the universe. And the total amount of it, this was the big discovery, I would say, in cosmology of the 20th century, was that it only amounts to 5% of all there is out there.
So what you're saying is that everything that we can discover is only 5% of what there really is.
Not really saying everything we can discover, because we hope we can discover also what's in the other 95%, and I guess today we will discuss that. But certainly everything which has been discovered so far can only amount up to 5%, unless we are completely misled by a very wide array of observations in astrophysics and cosmology. And to conclude this, big picture of the universe, what's the remaining 95%? Well, we believe, and we'll argue about that more in the rest of this discussion, is that 25% of that remaining 95% is made of dark matter, which is the main subject today, and then 70% is in the form of dark energy. And these are two mysterious substances, and I think, at least for what concerns the dark matter, we might be close to get an answer about what dark matter is.
And what's the difference between matter and energy?
Well, there's a fundamental energy. The only thing that dark matter and dark energy have in common is the word dark in the name. And they're not necessarily the best names we can give to the substances. They are more catchy names that we used just to broadly define these mysterious substances. For what concerns dark matter, what we know is that it must be, made probably of new particles with a mass. So particles that would be in a way similar to the fundamental particles we've discovered, but not exactly the same. So with different properties, would not be made of quarks and electrons, this matter. But otherwise, it would interact with the gravitational force, just like ordinary matter does. In the case of dark energy, the situation is even more complicated. What we know is that there is something which is pushing the universe and making it expand ever faster. If the matter that was all there was in the universe, then the universe would expand and then either recollapse on itself or expand, very, very slowly, to slow down basically the expansion.
But there's something that accelerates that process.
So in the 90s, some astronomers have discovered that the universe is not slowing down, it's actually accelerating the expansion. And the Nobel Prize in, I think, 2012 was precisely awarded to the people who discovered the accelerated expansion of the universe. Mm. Now, to describe that phenomenon, people have postulated the existence. Well, they've sort of recalled what Einstein did in the early 20th century, when people were trying to make sense basically of the implications of general relativity for cosmology. What Einstein did was to show basically that you can apply general relativity to the universe as a whole and describe its evolution and its structure. And what he noticed is that basically he could not explain the universe he was observing unless he postulated that there was an additional constant, the famous cosmological constant, in his equations. He was reluctant to introduce it because it was spoiling the elegance of his theory originally.
It was like a fabricated element in the equation that made sure that his model worked.
It was a sort of a patch to the theory, essentially. I mean, it was not contrary to any physical principle, but clearly not as elegant as the theory would have been in absence of it. And the funny fact is that, you know, he postulated that because nobody knew that the universe was expanding back then. You know, he had in mind a picture of a static universe. He thought his equations couldn't describe a static universe, so he said, let me introduce this patch to make sense of what we observe. He could have predicted the expansion of the universe. He would have been even more of a genius than he actually is. But then what people realized was that the universe was expanding, cosmological constant was abandoned. It came back and disappeared several times in the history of cosmology.
This cosmological constant.
This cosmological constant. And when the accelerated expansion of the universe was proposed and measured, it was the obvious way to explain the observations. You know, it is possible to show that if you add a cosmological constant, and once basically all the matter and ordinary matter and all the dark matter has become so diluted because of the expansion of the universe, so rare and diluted, you will be able to observe the effects of this cosmological constant that will start to push the universe apart. And that's that's how the evidence for this dark energy came about. There's one thing I wanted to mention about this difference between dark matter and dark energy. I always thought it was a bit misleading to say that the universe is made of 70%, 25%, and 5%, because it looks like, you know, the recipe in of a cake, basically. Mm. It seems to say, you know, that's all there is in the universe. And that this reflects something fundamental about the universe. And it does, sort of. But only if you keep in mind that the universe is, that this composition is dynamic. It's not fixed in time. If you go back to the epoch where structures like the galaxy we live in started to form, there was a completely different distribution of matter and energy in these different components.
We are always searching for a moment in time and looking at the division at that moment.
Precisely.
Yeah. So can it also become 7, 23, and...
It can't. No. No. No, it cannot be like that. You know, we know how these different components scale with time. You know, for each of this, that's, you know, the standard cosmology that we teach in our courses at the university. We teach our students how to calculate how, you know, radiation, so means photons and neutrinos and relativistic matter, scales with time, you know, how it's diluted due to the expansion of the universe, how matter, you know, like dark matter and ordinary matter, non-relativistic stuff, scales with time. And we know also how the cosmological constant scales with time. So if we have a snapshot today of the relative contribution, we can, you know, basically estimate the relative contribution back at the time when structures started to form. Hmm. And, you know, we have these fantastic observations of the cosmic microwave background that tell us very precisely, how the universe, how structures started to grow in the early universe. And in particular, we can say that when structures formed, what dominated the matter and energy distribution in the universe was dark matter. So if you want to understand how a galaxy, like the assembly of stars and gas that we observe when we look up at the sky, if you want to figure out how that formed in the universe, then dark matter is responsible for it.
But then dark matter is like the fundamental particle. Can I say particle?
Well, it's...
It bears the fundament of our universe.
I would say that it constitutes the scaffolding of the universe. You know, that basically it keeps together structures, it bounds structures.
Yeah.
Dark matter and dark energy have an opposite effect, actually. One, pulls together stuff. So, for instance, if you took the galaxy we live in, so which is a disk of stars and gas rotating a common center, within a big halo of dark matter, this was the big discovery at the end of in cosmology at the end of the 20th century, you know, through the 70s and 80s. If you remove this big halo of dark matter from the galaxy, you know, stars and planets would, you know, fly away like bullets in the sky.
I've read the analogy that it's like two people that are holding their hands and running circles, and then every time they run faster, the gravitational pull needs to be bigger, because otherwise they would...
That's right. You need a stronger force to pull things together.
So how can we see if we go back to... Because the dark energy, I think we're getting way technical there. If you look at dark matter, the thing about it is that it's dark. How can we see dark matter? How can we search for dark matter?
That's the big question in cosmology. And, as you can immediately see, is that, currently we have a perfect description of the universe, almost perfect actually. The price for that is to postulate the existence of things we cannot see, which is a very dangerous thing to do in cosmology, in science in general. We know, you know, many cases in which people have believed in the existence or assumed that something was out there. The typical example is the case of the ether. That was postulated in the 19th century. This was, you know, basically a substance, you know, ether, like in radio goes on ether. That was supposed to be, you know, the support structure for the propagation of waves in the universe. And this was so popular that we still use that term basically when discussing the propagation of electromagnetic waves. But we now know that there's, you know, nothing. Well, that it's always tricky to say it does not exist. But, you know, as Einstein correctly put it, we don't need it to explain the propagation of waves. You know, we got rid of that idea. And so this is something that was, you know, commonly accepted at the end of the 19th century, and now it's known to be wrong, essentially. We don't want to be in the same situation now. So, we're always very careful when making, you know, statements about, you know, we know everything in the universe. In order to prove that this dark matter is out there and that dark energy makes sense, we need to go out there and measure these particles. And what I describe in the book and in the app is basically how scientists are trying to discover, to detect these dark matter particles and prove all these assumptions, basically.
And how is that?
There are three main ways. One, which is, you know, maybe the one which is more familiar to our listeners, is that... we could create new particles, produce new particles at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. You know that there is this big accelerator at the border between Switzerland and France, and you know that people there basically are colliding particles, protons, as a matter of fact, to very high energies. And the idea is, you know, to search for dark matter is relatively simple, actually. The idea is the following. When you accelerate these particles to very high energies, you can produce in the collision very massive particles. You know the equation E equal mc squared. If you increase a lot the energy of the collision, you can produce mass particles with a mass, which is on the right side of this equation, which is very high. Okay? So the idea is that by colliding protons at the LHC, you would produce these very massive particles, and then you search among the debris of the collision, basically, you search for these new particles. It's technically very difficult to do, but it's certainly, you know, a very clear way of obtaining evidence for new particles. That's actually how the Higgs boson was discovered.
But to take it one step back, if we're looking for dark matter, then we're looking for something that we can't see, so we search for other signs that show us that it's there. Like, for
the
example,
effects.
Yeah,
that's right. So we want to prove the particle nature of dark matter. So, for instance, and we want to measure the dark matter particles.
But is it then like if you have a paperclip on a table and the paperclip starts to move, you know that there's a magnet underneath it.
That's the indirect evidence that we have today.
And then the magnet would be the dark matter.
That's
in the analogy.
So the indirect evidence that we have today is that, you know, we see these effects, these collective gravitational effects on things we observe. Let me give you like a historical analogy to what happened in the case of dark matter. In the 19th century, people were applying the laws of Newton gravity, basically, to the motion of planets in the solar system. Okay, and then they were, you know, the degree of sophistication of this calculation was basically so advanced that they could measure precisely the orbit of these planets and compare it with the prediction, the predicted orbit for these planets, you know, taking into account the sun and all the other planets in the universe. Okay,
so that's again the two people holding hands.
That's right.
Turning around.
There's a gravitational pull which is provided by the planets you observe. Now, when they looked in to the motion of outer planets like Uranus, for instance, they realized that Uranus was not moving at all as predicted. Well, I shouldn't say at all. There was a tiny modification, a tiny anomaly in the motion of Uranus. And people like Le Verrier, the observatory in Paris, said, look, this doesn't make sense. So either my calculations are wrong, which is something which is very hard to accept for a scientist, or there must be a new planet of this mass in that position, which is perturbing the motion of this planet. Sure enough, you know, next year, the following year, the planet was discovered. It was Neptune that was perturbing the orbit of Uranus. Now, the analogy is the following. We are observing anomalies in the outer parts of the galaxy that, you know, clearly tell us that we cannot explain the motion of stars and gas in the outer parts of galaxy, of all the galaxies we observe, without postulating the existence of an additional form of matter. Like we postulate the existence of a new planet to explain that anomaly, we need to postulate new matter to explain this anomaly. And if we do that, everything makes sense. If we don't, it doesn't. So we do, but there's a catch. The very same Le Verrier who postulated the existence of Neptune tried to explain the anomaly in the orbit of Mercury that was discovered, you know, a few years later. And it is known that the orbit of Mercury, which is the planet which is closer to the Sun, actually exhibits what is called an anomalous precession of the perihelion. I mean, it does have a funny orbit around the Sun, basically, which is not predicted by Newtonian gravity. And then he said, he was strong about idea of postulating the existence of a new planet in the outer solar system. And he said, this makes sense if there is a new planet in the inner part of the solar system between Mercury and the Sun, which is perturbing the orbit of Mercury. But that planet was never found. He even dubbed it Vulcan, you know. If you're passionate science fiction, you may have heard about Vulcanians and so on. That's where this all started, basically. But that planet was never found. You know, we're pretty sure that it's not there actually after a century. And so this poses also, you know, this kind of strange situation. And you know, the answer had to await Einstein's theory of general relativity. So the answer was not a new form of matter, but it was a new theory of gravity. So that's the other possibility, you know, that we are, you know, being mistaken or misled by all these observations, but that the real answer is in the form of a new theory of gravity. But let me, you know, before you ask the next question, because I see you want to ask the next question, let me just tell you that. There are good reasons to believe that we are not in that case of modified gravity.
That we're not in the case of that it's a different theory of gravity.
That's right. The strongest evidence against it is that we observe systems in which we observe, well, the total mass is, again, by using a tool that comes from the Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is the so-called gravitational lensing. You know, we see mass through the effect it has on the propagation of light rays of distant galaxies, of background images. So if you look, for instance, at a cluster of galaxies, you can say where the mass in that cluster is. The other observation you can perform is to ask the question, where is ordinary matter, you know, what we call baryonic matter, so the stuff, atoms, basically, that we observe in the universe, and we can compare whether the baryons, the standard matter we're familiar with, sits on top of the ordinary mass. sits on top of the reconstructed mass, the mass reconstructed from gravitational lensing. And there are some cases in which the two are in two completely different places. And that's quite a strong argument against this theory of modified gravity, because this tells us, you know, quite directly that the baryons, the standard matter, is not the source of the gravitational potential. It's not all the matter which is out there. In fact, it's not even most of it.
Because that would imply that it's enough to have this normal matter and this normal mass, and that then
it just doesn't work.
No. Okay, so I think before we go further with our conversation, it's good to have a small break from all the technical and then also try to find out in the next part of our edition today why we even should bother to talk about this matter. But first, Mars Needs Woman by Nova Star.